Hey, everybody. My name is Damara West, and I'm founder of Be Well, Beautiful Woman, where we help women to center their healing and liberation so that they can lead and live on their own terms. I am overjoyed about welcoming you into the Abundance Summit, which is all about amplifying your power to draw in more money, more joy, and more ease. And I've got some amazing speakers from across the globe that are going to inspire us to do just that. And right now, I've got in the lineup Laura Van Dernot Lipsky. Hopefully, I pronounced that right, Laura.
So good.
Okay, good. All right. So she is the founder and director of the Trauma Stewardship Institute and author of The Trauma Stewardship and The Age of Overwhelm. She is the host of the podcast Future Tripping, which is dedicated to conversations about overwhelm. She's widely recognized as a pioneer in the field of trauma exposure, where she has worked nationally and internationally for more than three decades. Much of her work is being invited to assist in the aftermath of community catastrophes, whether they are fatal storms or mass shootings. Simultaneously, she has long been active in community organizing and movements for social and environmental justice, and has taught on issues surrounding systemic oppression, structural supremacy, and liberation theory. Laura is on the advisory board of Z Girls, an organization that supports young girls in sports, and she is the founding member of the International Transformational Resilience Network, which supports the development of capacity to address climate change. She also served as an associate producer of the award-winning film, A Lot Like You, and was given a Yo Mama Award in recognition of her work as a community activist mother. Laura, I am so glad that you are here with me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's dive right in. I would love for you to talk with us about the Trauma Stewardship Institute and then your book that came out, right, about trauma stewardship. I actually was required to read your book as a part of my trauma-informed certificate training program. And so when we found you in relationship to this summit, I was like, oh my gosh, what a dream come true to have you be a part of this beautiful offering. So talk to us about the Institute and what led you to start it along with author Trauma Stewardship.
Thank you. It's very kind words. Thank you so much. The Institute came about after I'd done my work in trauma for quite some time and really as a response to the need, both for individuals getting support, but also collectively. So communities needing support, organizations, agencies, systems, and structures. So we do both crisis response. So when very, very, very sad things happen places, we're one of the people who gets asked to come in and try to help. And then we also try to do a lot of prevention work with communities, as well as organizations, agencies, system structures on what trauma is, what vicarious trauma is, what overwhelm looks like, what's the difference between those things and burnout. And then we also do education connected with that. And then sometimes we'll be asked to come in to agencies and organizations that not on the prevention end, but that are already struggling quite a bit. And then we try to come in through organization and support and try to help provide some scaffolding. So yeah, those different pieces. And then the book came about, I'm not a writer at all. So the book came about because I was asked to write something about the work and didn't do it for a long time. I had little kids and the work is kind of incessant. But finally after I went to New Orleans to volunteer and do some, try to offer some support after Hurricane Katrina. And so when I was leaving there, people asked if I had anything written down I could leave with them, and I didn't. Felt horrible. So came home, and then with Connie Burke, my co-author, we wrote Trauma Stewardship. Yeah. And the second book is The Age of Overwhelm, which came out a few years ago, which kind of pitches a wider tent about overwhelm.
Yeah. So this leads me to something you illuminated in your response, this distinction, right, between vicarious trauma and burnout. So talk to us about what the difference is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. Vicarious trauma, I mean, in the least clinical way to talk about it, vicarious trauma is where you are exposed over time to really hard things, suffering, hardship, crisis, trauma of humans, other living beings, ecologically, what's happening on the planet. It can be personal, like you can be a caretaker to somebody, your mom who's got cancer, your dad who's got Alzheimer's, your brother who came home from Afghanistan years ago. So it can be personal or it can be professional. You can be a librarian, you can be a surgeon, you can be running a foster care agency, you can be doing, you know, content moderation at one of the tech firms, like any job where you're exposed to really hard things. So it can be personal, professional, can be individual, like you individually can be navigating it, or you could find like your whole team, you know, your whole unit, your whole department, your whole agency, as well as of course, families and communities. So there's a personal, professional, individual, collective. And as a result of exposure to something hard over time, you really start to feel like you're a different person. You come to see the world in a different way. And there's kind of a constellation we came up with of what's called the trauma exposure response, where you might notice, you know, you feel like you can never do enough, or you might notice you're tired all the time, or you might notice what's called negativity bias, where like you're having a very hard time assuming well about others, or you might notice feeling more cynical, you might notice feeling super numb, right? So any number of things, but there's kind of a circle that we have that folks can find on the website. And then, you know, then you just notice over time, like just how you're engaging in the world is different than it used to be. So that's largely what we talk about with vicarious trauma. Burnout is different in that there's overlap, but it's different in that burnout, we usually think about it where you're being asked to do something you cannot possibly do with the resources you have in the time frame you've been given. And there are many ways that burnout can be avoidable. There's certain places vicarious trauma, you're not going to be able to avoid it, but certainly folks should know if it's coming from work, for example, that from a place of self-respect, they should aspire to be in a workplace, even if it might not be the case. But again, from a place of self-respect, know that at least I think where we work, those places have a moral mandate and ethical obligation to create sustainable environments where we do this work. Yeah. There's certain jobs though, where you just know you're entering in and there's gonna be vicarious trauma. Like you just know as a result of the work you're doing, there will be vicarious trauma. Still, there should be support in place. Burnout doesn't have to be inevitable, but what happens at least in the United States, I know you have folks from joining from all over, so I don't wanna speak about other countries, but in the United States, I don't want to provide an analysis of other countries. I just know I can say critically in the United States, because our society is so overdeployed, many of these agencies and organizations become very overdeployed, get really in over their head. And even if well-intentioned, they are going to go on too few resources trying to do too much. And part of what gets problematic there is it falls then on individual workers.
Yeah.
So with that burnout, you find yourself being asked to do things you can't do with the resources you have in the time frame you begin. Again, even if it's well-intentioned mission of the agency or organization, you find over time that each individual worker is being blamed or being held responsible, or at least blaming themselves that they can't keep up. Right. So that's why we really have to look at, even if it requires grieving and mourning and having big feelings, as we say with kids, about not being able to do everything we want to do, it's unfair to create these environments where it's a setup. So you see that with school teachers, you see it with nurses, right? You see it with public health workers, you see it with, you know, cops. I mean, you see it with any number of folks where they came in hoping to do work, you know, in an integrity filled way, you know, let's assume well, right? And then as a result of the system they're in, it's just very, very, very hard to do that. And that's where you can see burnout there. You can certainly see it in a family too. I mean, I think most parents would probably say they're frequently burnt out, right? And that's, again, I don't want to critique in any way other countries, but in our country, the United States, it's just a setup for parents. I mean, in terms of, and to say nothing about grandparents who are raising their grandkids or aunt and uncles or guardians, there's just, it's so individualistic. So a lot of parents, a lot of caregivers are burned out. And then you can also imagine caregivers, you know, for if you've got somebody ill in your family, if you have a child who's struggling, right? You can, I mean, a lot of family members will say, a lot of shame comes with it, unfortunately, but if they're honest, many of them would say that they feel very burnt out because of the lack of societal support. Yeah. So you can get burnt out personally, right? And then you can get burnt out through your job. And then I work with a ton with students. I mean, and most students would say they're very, very, very burnt out too.
Yeah.
So unfortunately.
So if people are, you know, enduring vicarious trauma by virtue of the work that they do as a therapist, as a social worker, as a foster care worker, as a frontline worker, then they're more prone to burnout, right? I mean, in part because they have this elevated exposure of stress and really holding this, the stress of the families that they are, or the children, or whomever it is that they're charged to support within their work. And so knowing that, you know, systems really have a responsibility, as you talked about, knowing that this conference, of course, is targeted towards individuals and in part who may run institutions. Mm-hmm. So from an individual level, what can we do to buffer ourselves if we're in the situation where we're exposed to a lot of vicarious trauma? And knowing that these practices, of course, are probably good practices for people to counter burnout as well, but we're talking about elevated things because the exposure is that much more pervasive. But then also for those who have an opportunity to change their systems to be some more supportive of individuals who are countering this within their work, what can individuals and organizations do to buffer this? Some tips for us.
Yeah, it's really good questions. So there's a few things. I mean, I think burnout and vicarious trauma, as you were saying, like I think it's important to think about, like, it can go both ways, right? Like, because you're in a high burnout environment, you might be more vulnerable to vicarious trauma. And then if you're in an environment where there's like a lot of vicarious trauma, you can be more vulnerable to burnout too, right? Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, thinking about it in a number of different ways, there are certain things in life. I mean, I want to assume that we get to make choices about so many things in life. There are going to be some things in life that we have a lot of choice around, and there's going to be some things in life we have very few choices around, just many fewer choices, right? So for example, if you are caretaking your dad who's got early onset Alzheimer's, hopefully we can get you some more support. We can get you less isolated, right? We can pull in some resources. However, you might continue to do that caretaking, you know, similarly parenting wise. Okay. So I think some is acknowledging what's in our control and what's not in our control. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then making some really clear choices around, if I'm going to choose to be a parent, if I'm going to choose to continue to take care of my dad who's got early onset Alzheimer's, what resources do I need to pull in? What scaffolding do I need? What help do I need to try to find, even though it can be really, really hard, so I'm less isolated, so there's less burnout, and honestly, so there might be like less vicarious trauma as well. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's like sometimes like assessing what we have choice over, what we don't have choice over. Then there's our jobs, right? And sometimes people have tons of choice over their jobs. Sometimes people are like, I can do this, 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 this. Then there's other people who are like, I can't, like, I'm not, like, it would be very hard to leave. Either I'm retiring in 2 years, or I'm in a place where I can't get another job, or whatever it might be. Or I love this work and I don't want to leave. So, but again, we want to assess what's in our control, what's not in our control, right? So just kind of having that sense, because that is like one of the first places you can do something about this, is assessing like, okay, what's in my control and what's out of my control? And then how do I respond in a way that's constructive and edifying?
Yeah. And well, and it seems like so intuitive to do this. And yet we know that individuals who are in these situations, they don't feel like they're in control. They feel like everything that comes along with this caretaking or this role, being in the trenches, being on the front line, that there isn't a lot of room. And yet, you know, part of this summit and abundance is this acknowledgement that we always have some power. So then let's talk about, what power do you have? What vision do you have over this? And if your vision is X, Y, and Z, let's figure out how we can support you in that vision while the people that need you are still getting the support, but you're getting the support that you need for yourself, for you first. And then, of course, for the people that you're privileged to serve, both through caretaking for a family member, but also just being in the work, right? There is such a privilege when we're working with people that are in the midst of trauma.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think with what you're saying, I mean, this, you know, you can look at spiritual leader after like liberation-based leader after religious. I mean, there's so many people throughout time who have taught us that even when so much is out of your control,
Yeah.
One of the things that we have control over is how we're going to react and how we're going to respond. That can be super tough to say to a parent in the midst of something, or a caretaker in the midst of something, or a worker in the midst of something. But I do think a very important place to start with this is just doing some assessing of, like, currently this is out of my control and currently this is in my control. And given that, what am I going to do? Then I think in terms of what you're asking about, you know, let's say it's because of your job that you're experiencing this and not on the personal front. For most people, it's a whole combination of things. And then we're also just in society where, like, on every front, whether it's climate or democracies or what's happening around the world, it's just people are being inundated. Let's say because of your work, you're navigating this. I think, again, whether or not your workplace is trauma informed, whether or not your workplace has a lot of integrity around this, just knowing what you deserve from a place of self-respect goes a long way. And what I mean by that is, it's one thing to work in a place that might be compromised, that might be struggling, that's not trauma informed, where it's a high burnout, but to be able to go there every day, and as you said, like, I'm going to show up, I'm going to do the best I can, I'm going to bring my A game to this. This place is out of control in so many ways. It is like bananas in so many ways. I'm going to bring my best, but I'm not going to internalize the bullshit. I'm not going to internalize, like, any of this. I'm just going to show up, I'm going to do my best. That's very different than going and being a worker in one of these places and just internalizing it all. And feeling like the reason that you can't get your job done or do it well or help these people or serve these people is because you're not efficient enough, or you're not dedicated enough, or you're not focused enough. Like, historically, there's been all this nonsense of, if you're cool enough and tough enough and dedicated enough and you care enough, like, you're going to shut your mouth, put your head down and do the job, right? And that has never ended well. Ever, ever, ever does that end well. There's a tremendous amount of harm. So I think first, just people understanding that even if it's aspirational, even if it's not what my current organization, agency, business is, I know what I at least deserve. And so I'm not going to internalize this.
Yeah.
And you can do any number of things to try to create, like, microclimates in there. So you have one or two or three colleagues in solidarity where you encourage each other to, like, not internalize it. You encourage each other to, like, actually sit and eat lunch. You encourage each other to get home to your kid's soccer game and not do three more reports, even if that can feel like small things. And then from a leadership standpoint, I mean, I really very much look at leadership for this, but I don't want folks to become disheartened, you know. But from a leadership standpoint, it's everything from making sure you're not creating an environment that's a setup for your colleagues, not like an intentional setup. But even if you care so much about your cause, if you're creating a system where you're overextended, that's going to fall on the individual workers. So it's everything from doing that to, even if you're in a massive system that you can't change overnight, like a big system that you're not going to be able to turn around, at least communicating to your colleagues, esteemed colleagues, as your leader, I'm so sorry it's gotten to this point. I'm so sorry it's this out of control. We are deeply, deeply sorry. And we see you struggling and we see you suffering. And we want you to know we're so grateful for you. And don't internalize this, right? Like, it's even if a leader can't shift the whole system overnight, being able to let colleagues know this isn't you, right? We don't want you to actually feel like you're losing your mind because you can't get this done, or you can't tend to this, or you're not able to help people. That goes a long way. And then you figure out how to start shifting things so it's actually sustainable. So the work is actually sustainable.
Yeah. And so, you know, what just occurred to me and what you just said, when I think about the emotional guidance scale, so often when we think we can't change anything, it stifles us, right? We can't move because, like, well, I'm not going to do anything from this place because I know that whatever I feel that whatever I do from this place is not really going to help because I can't fix the thing. And yet with the acknowledgement in itself, the recognition that I see you in the midst of this and know that I'm advocating for you. No, I can't change this overnight, but know that I'm showing up for you. And let's figure out collectively what we can do to soften this for us in the midst of the reality of what we have to contend with. Like, that's a power move. And I think that sometimes when we think about power, we think about these grand gestures, but the reality is that any form of forward action is power. Like, if we're not doing anything because we feel as if we can't do anything, then we're actually causing ourselves harm and usually causing the people around us harm as well. And so I really love this because it does change the energy just by virtue of acknowledging it, because speaking is a form of doing. And not that we should only speak, right? We need to be activating change, right? But speaking is certainly an important part, as you offered, during these times of intensity. So, you know, what I know to be true is that trauma stewardship is, I would say, kind of a blueprint for living an abundant life if you're in the trenches, right, and doing this work. And so, you know, outside of all of this, this framework that you just gave us for tips, right, within an institution when we're faced with this, in terms of what the book says, what are the top tips that we can apply in our lives to live abundantly in spite of the ways that vicarious trauma adversely affect us?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. And one of the things I want to just really emphasize what you were saying there, that one of the points that I think is really important that you surfaced is understanding this kind of razor's edge of wanting to never take away someone's agency and never underestimate the power and accountability that we have, you know, as humans, while simultaneously balancing that with folks understanding how they should be treated, how they should be treated in society, how they should be treated in one's job, how they should be treated. And again, even if it's aspirational, even if it's not the reality, but knowing that, like, I understand this is not how I should be treated. And you know, do what Viktor Frankl and Desmond Tutu and countless Wangari Maathai, so many people before us have talked about, where there's a way that you insulate yourself, that you don't give away your power. I think part of why that's so important to connect it to what you're saying, and the reason I never talk about this in terms of self-care, and I say that with respect, but it's very important to me, at least when I do this work, I don't want folks leaving my presence feeling like it's a big to-do list for them to do, or that it's this individual pursuit of, like, okay, everybody, one-on-one, I need you to work on turning your frowns upside down, right? Like, I don't want it to be reduced to that. So I want us all to have skills, and I want us all to have resources, and I want us all to know, like, right at our fingertips, what we can do for self-preservation and to be able to not just survive, but thrive as well. And that has to be held of paramount importance with understanding what society needs to do and shift, right? So folks can actually function and survive and have a chance of, like, making democracies continuing, right? And what agencies, organizations, and systems need to do and how they need to hold themselves accountable. So this doesn't solely get reductive into self-care.
Yeah.
And so I think that's very, very important. So when you're asking about kind of, you know, top things to do, I think first and foremost, looking at the structural and the systemic piece, and either being able to change the structural and systemic piece, or if you can't, having that as a frame of understanding that part of the reason, you know, a 16-year-old is struggling in high school is not because, like, something's wrong with them. It's because we've created a whole education system and a whole larger system for adolescents where there's so many headwinds that it's like near impossible, right? Same thing with a worker, same thing with a family member. So first, understanding it in terms of that. So I think there's many things that systems and structures can do, like we talked about, in terms of not getting over deployed, creating sustainable environments. As you said, even if that can't be shifted, at least you communicate out, like, workers, we're so sorry, here's what we're striving for, okay? And we, out of respect for you, we want you to know kind of what the direction is so you can make a choice to leave or stay, or, like, how you're gonna do work for self-preservation. And then I think individually, you know, a lot of what I talk about, which is a longer conversation, but again, a lot can be found on our website. There's a TED Talk, there's interviews, there's handouts people can download for free and everything. But I talk with a lot with people about their nervous system, and both their own individual nervous system, but the nervous system of their family, the nervous system of their community, of their neighborhood, of their workplace, of movements they're a part of, and how we want to be very mindful to have conditions in place that we don't get saturated. So there's two things primarily. You want to, number one, be very mindful about anything you're exposing yourself to that would jack up your nervous system and otherwise cause it to become saturated. And number two, you want to have conditions in place that when things are arising in your nervous system because of exposure to life, you have a way to saturate it. You have a way to desaturate it by metabolizing it. Mm-hmm. So you want to first make sure you're not exposing yourself to anything unintentionally that would otherwise jack up your nervous system, cause you to become saturated. And then also you want to have conditions in place that help you metabolize so you can desaturate. Mm. And those are, we have countless suggestions in terms of what to do there that are efficient and effective and don't cost things and that are not out of reach at all, right? We really try to look at the most efficient, most effective, least expensive strategies. So folks can go to traumastewardship.com. You'll see interviews on there. You'll see TED Talk on there. You'll see, like, you know, top things that people can do. Both, you can just, you know, listen to that when you're doing laundry, you're driving, walking your dog. And then there's under the handout section, there's a number of handouts. And those are pretty comprehensive that folks can just at their leisure read through. And that should give folks like a really good foundation of just some directions they could choose.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll definitely make sure that folks have links to all of that to make it super easy to access that. And before you tell us maybe just a couple of those, right? The on both domains, we'll call them right now for the sake of this conversation. I just want to acknowledge, right? Sorry, not sorry. I think that you're, you know, inviting us in to think about that this well beyond, this is not just about self-care. And you said it, it's about self-preservation. And it's about how when our systems are not set up to buffer us in the midst of countering vicarious trauma, how that harms us even more, right? And whose responsibility is it to counter this? Well, it's all of our responsibility, right? But don't just put it on me as the individual to go and work on my work-life balance, which is important. And I don't want to minimize that. But when people are in the trenches doing this work, it's no joke. And it is a shock to their nervous system over and over and over again. And if it's not getting out somehow, and if our systems aren't changing to support us, then we're perpetuating this. We're feeding into the cycle of burnout, which is why we see the recycling of people on the front lines. Typically, you know, people don't last very long, right? And they're lasting for less and less time because our bodies can't take it. Our nervous systems can't take it. So knowing that we've got a plethora of resources that we can pull on, give us maybe three in both domains that are super easy for us to apply in our lives.
So in terms of refraining from exposing yourself to things that would otherwise jack up your nervous system, one is, if you're on social media, consider getting off of social media. If you're on social media for edifying, constructive, focused, intentional reasons that you think are of great benefit to you, that's one thing. But you want to be very mindful of duration, time of day, how you engage. The second is following the news. I'm not somebody who's ever going to tell you to not work for social or environmental justice. What I'm saying about following the news is your nervous system won't be able to withstand following the news in an unintentional, unmindful, not deliberate way. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to follow the news, making sure, again, you're very mindful about the time of day, the duration, what news you're following, how you take it in, right? Mm-hmm. And then the third there in terms of refraining is, you know, being very mindful of relationships, both how you engage in them and what you consume through conversations, through different ways. So those are some examples of consumption, being super mindful and deliberate. In terms of metabolizing, this can be anything from getting your heart rate up and breaking a sweat, being very intentional about, like, anything that's accumulated in my nervous system, let me release it. It has a lot of mindfulness through mindfulness practices, and not in the way of just like, take a deep breath, go outside. And, like, you know, you want to just like, so get so frustrated with people when they say that. It's just being very efficient, understanding what the most efficient things you could do to regulate your nervous system. And some of those things are, you know, being very, very, very intentional about making sure you're continuing to metabolize just in your nervous system, which has to do with breathing. It also has to do with going outside, whether or not you like nature or not. But those are just the realities of what helps you regulate your nervous system, right? Another thing that I think many people take for granted is sleep, just trying to understand where sleeping helps with grieving, it helps with mourning, it helps with reconciling everything that's overwhelming, you know? So those are some examples. And again, and sometimes we can have them talk to us in a way that's like just has been historically very simplistic, but understanding that what we're trying to do there is help you metabolize what's in your nervous system.
Absolutely. Right?
And those things you can do in a very intentional way that are accessible, that aren't out of reach.
Yeah, those are really great examples. Thank you for that. So you're running an institute, you know, you've authored books, you're hosting podcasts, you're in the trenches, in moments when we're experiencing devastation, right? You're right there, you and your team. So how do you keep abundance at the forefront of your efforts, or self-preservation, as you have coined it?
Well, not coined it, but use the term.
Okay. Good point.
I won't take responsibility for that term.
You have kept the term alive. How about that? You have played your part in keeping the term alive.
I use it a lot. I mean, I'm very blessed. I have a very, very blessed life, and a few things, you know, I have people around me who help me laugh a lot. I think, you know, humor can be incredibly, I mean, humor done well can be very, 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 like, incredibly sustaining. I live in a beautiful place, so I get to spend a lot of time outside, you know, just like a beautiful region. So that helps me a lot. And then I am incredibly pretty rigid about what I expose myself to in turn. Like, I'm not on, so I can't, like, social media, I think, would just break my brain if I had to, like, navigate that. I'm just very, very intentional about what I take in, and that's just kind of because I couldn't function otherwise. And then just making sure that there's time, you know, Buddhism talks so beautifully about making sure you are exposing yourself to things that are beautiful, whether that's like a tree changing colors, right? Or stopping to, like, pet a dog, or, you know, making time to call a friend or something, but not underestimating the power of, like, trying to be present with some things that are really, really beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, knowing that, you know, as we get ready to wrap up, we're in the midst of witnessing a genocide that's unfolding right now as we speak. And not the first time, and unfortunately, it probably won't be the last. And so, knowing that we, you know, most of us are far removed from this, right? But we're feeling it. We're feeling the magnitude of it, whether it be, you know, an alert that comes up on my phone about an article, or scrolling through social media, right? Even intentionally not being a part of it, but still somehow, somewhere, conversations. Mm-hmm. So what can we all do to self, you know, preserve in the midst of that, knowing that there is immense suffering that's happening in the world, and yet we're here. Mm-hmm. So what can we do for ourselves during times like this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really important question. I appreciate you asking. I mean, I think to do justice to that, as you know, is a much longer conversation. So I want to honor your question by saying it is a much longer conversation, and very complex conversation. I think what we know to be true is that I think for humans, it is really important to not underestimate what we can do, that even if there is distance, you know, geographic distance, for example, between us and where suffering is unfolding, not underestimating what we can do in our immediate vicinity. If you believe in interbeing, right? If you believe that that is true in life, that there is a connection between all of us, then understanding how powerful it can be to act in very constructive, very edifying, very nurturing, right? Very focused ways in your immediate environment to try to impact change where you can, and not thinking that because you can't impact something, like, on the ground directly, perhaps where suffering is unfolding, that it's all just hopeless. Mm-hmm. So making sure that we're able to continue to get out of bed every day and not cause harm to ourselves, and continue on with life, even when things can feel so insurmountable, through finding ways that in our vicinity, to the best of our ability, we are doing what we can to act constructively and act very mindfully and not cause any harm. Yeah. Right. And then continuing to look for ways that have also a very direct impact.
That's beautiful. So before we share with the audience how they can stay in touch with you, what final piece of advice do you have for folks that are, you know, really resonating with this message of vicarious trauma, and also wanting to really have abundance in every facet of their lives, in spite of the ways that it's challenging, right, to really tap into that because of our caretaking or the work that we do day in and day out.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I would say is making sure that you're not isolated. I think that's one of the most important things, and that will look different for everybody. But one of the most damaging things for humans is being isolated or feeling isolated when it comes to anything related to oppression, supremacy of any kind, or trauma. So I think anything folks can do to make sure that they're not isolated.
That's so beautiful. And all the research is showing, right, that if we want to live well, we have to be in community, right? We have to have at least a couple close relationships in order to buffer all that life will throw at us. So I have enjoyed our time so, so much. Please share with the audience how they can stay in touch with you. We'll make sure that they've got all of these good links so that they can do that with ease, but please just verbally share that with us as we get.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you again for having me. The website's traumastewardship.com. The podcast is called Future Tripping. The Instagram we have is at Future Tripping with Laura. So those are three ways.
All right. Wonderful. Again, we're going to make sure that folks have all of this. Again, Laura, thank you for being in partnership with me for the Global Abundance Summit. And y'all heard it here. Until next time, Ashe.
Thank you.